The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is the global burden of disease?
The Global Burden of Disease study is the equivalent of Google Earth for health. You can survey an entire continent like Africa and see every disease and injury that's killing people and making them sick, or zoom in on the United States, or on middle-aged women, or on just Missoula County. The idea is first diagnose, see all your health problems, then prescribe, come up with specific solutions if you want to help people the most.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Jeremy Smith about his book, Epic Measures, One Doctor, 7 Billion Patients. Epic Measures includes statistical information, for sure, but mostly it's the story of a man, Chris Murray, who is determined to know how we, all of us on the planet, live and die. You wrote that before his 18th birthday, Chris had decided that, quote, conventional wisdom can kill and that, quote, science can save lives. How did he come to that conclusion?
When he was 10 years old, he traveled with his family across the Sahara Desert to help operate a hospital in Niger, then and now one of the poorest countries on earth. There's a 10-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 17-year-old, mom and dad, and they're basically operating this hospital in the most dire conditions by themselves. They encounter drought, famine, people with tuberculosis, anthrax, you know, lots of trouble just with basic childbirth. But they also found that some of the basic medical techniques that were advised for people operating a hospital under their circumstances were actually making people sicker. The family did research in this area to save the lives of the people they were trying to help, and then they published that research, which was kind of remarkable. So by the time he's 13 years old, Chris Murray is co-author on a peer-reviewed scientific publication in the British medical journal, The Lancet. At 10 years old, he's thrust into the position of pharmacist for a hospital. And by the time he's 18, a freshman in college, he's had almost a decade of medical experience working in different sites all across Africa.
Let's hear a passage from the book in which young Chris ponders how to make the world, the whole world, healthier.
So he goes to Harvard, and then he becomes a Rhodes Scholar, and he's at Oxford. Say you wanted to make the whole world healthier, Murray asked early in his research for his Oxford doctoral dissertation. How would you do that? A decade earlier, the answer had been simple, at least to economists. Sick people tended to be poor. To get better, they just had to get richer. Poor people were hungry. Money bought food. Poor people washed and drank near where they defecated. Money bought plumbing. Poor people lacked medical care. Money bought vaccines and the trained men and women in bright white coats to deliver them. The doctor and demographic historian Thomas McEwen, who had studied declining mortality in England and Wales from 1850 to 1970, typified the current thinking. Compare developed and developing countries, said McEwen, and there is little doubt that the difference in health experience are attributable mainly to the direct or indirect effects of poverty and would be largely eliminated if it were possible to raise the lower standard of living and medical care to the level of the highest. Then opinion changed. A few intrepid researchers ventured outside the library, laboratory, and classroom. They visited primary health care projects around the world. There they discovered something both completely obvious and largely ignored. Not all poor people were the same. Yes, all had relatively little money, but reports repeatedly heralded residents of some low-income countries, China, Costa Rica, Sri Lanka, and the state of Kerala in India, as healthier than others, and, in terms of mortality rate improvement, doing even better than those in many wealthy Western nations. According to the World Bank, for example, China, Sri Lanka, and Kerala each had per capita incomes of at most $330 in the early 1980s. Nonetheless, in all of them, life expectancy at birth approached 70 years. In Costa Rica, income per capita was $1,000, an order of magnitude less than in the United States. Yet the two countries' infant and adult mortality rates were about equal. The old model of health improvement, based on economic growth, had been dubbed the Northern Paradigm. The new model, called the Southern Paradigm, was centered on equal access to health care, education, and nutrition. For instance, the Rockefeller Foundation would publish a highly influential 1985 report, Good Health at Low Cost, promoting China's patriotic health campaign, Costa Rica's universal health insurance, Sri Lanka's land reform movement, and Kerala's rural nurse midwives as reasons residents of those areas were living better. Hard data was sketchy, however, and largely limited to average life expectancy. Who was really extraordinary, Murray asked, and what specific interventions did the greatest good? At the library, he pulled every statistical compendium he could find from UN agencies and the World Bank, the two leading sources of international health data. He wanted to understand two things. First, how do you come up with a comprehensive summary of the health of a population so you can actually say Sweden is healthier than Canada or Niger is less healthy than Nigeria? Second, what specific factors lead some countries to do better than others at the same income level? How do we know who's really exceptional so we can replicate that experience, Murray wondered. What is the strength of the evidence piecing together data in a really imperfect world? Work in international public health might be the best way to make our planet healthier, happier, more prosperous, and more peaceful, Murray thought. It was arguably the most important work in the world. But how could we say what would make people live better if we couldn't even be certain when and how they were dying?
So here's this very young man asking these huge, huge questions. And the question of how to make our planet healthier, happier, more prosperous, he's proposing to do this with data. And it seems like an incredible question for a man that age to ask. Did he have a notion at that time of what he would do with the data if he found it?
In his childhood, traveling across Africa, even when he was the youngest of this family of four, even if, when he was just 9, 10 years old, he was always the navigator for the family. He'd be studying maps and determining their routes where there often weren't even any roads. And I think he realized, as other map-obsessed people might, that if you're in a car going faster and faster and faster, but you're lost, you're not going to get there sooner. Someone needs to make a map to tell you where you're going. And he saw this opportunity. I can be the one to make the map.
So at the heart of global burden is information that can help governments and organizations allocate money for public health. And many countries have already done that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But we're talking about a lot of money, $7 trillion, you say in the book, which is 10% of the global economy. That's every year. What are we spending $7 trillion on?
Healthcare spending has risen rapidly around the world. It's now close to 20% of spending in the United States, which is, of course, the world's largest economy. And we're usually reacting to crises as they happen rather than trying to anticipate or prevent them because we can't see trends because we don't have comprehensive data. Or we're allocating resources based on who has the most vocal or most visible advocacy group. So if Bono or Angelina Jolie trumpet a cause, many people are going to hear about it. That doesn't mean it's always the most important cause if you want to save the most lives. So at some point you need to stop, get this big picture view and say, what's really going on? Without that view, what they find when you look at this, the global burden of disease data, and I talk about this over and over again in Epic Measures, is you often have 90% of your resources dealing with 10% of your problems, and half your problems aren't even on your map. You're not dealing with them at all. So there's whole populations, whole communities, whole causes of illness, injury, death, disability that no one's working on at all until you can see the big picture.
They're all looking at causes that have to do with children because that's what tweaks people's emotions.
Think about how many postcards or fundraising appeals you get around Christmas time with a wide-eyed child or a mother on the cover. And of course, we want to save the lives of children. But the fact is, even in Niger, even a generation ago, 90% of very young, sick children survived. And when they survive their childhood, who's looking out for them then? Mm-hmm. What stops them from being killed as teenagers in car accidents, or 25-year-olds in violent incidents, or 35-year-olds in childbirth, or 45-year-olds of AIDS, or of cancer, or of heart disease, or of stroke, these so-called lifestyle conditions that we think are unique to the United States or the Western world? 2/3 of deaths from these conditions, I believe, occur in developing countries. And most people who die in poor countries die from the same kind of diseases that we die from here in the United States.
I remember a statistic. I didn't write it down, so I can't quote it, but it had to do with the roads. Once they found out how many people were dying in traffic accidents, didn't they oust the transportation minister and rebuild all the roads?
I think the story I tell in Epic Measures is about road injuries in Iran. We think of Iran as a closed society, as a backward-looking society, but there were some innovative demographers, epidemiologists, medical professionals, and they realized our communities aren't dying from infectious diseases that they were in the 1950s. They're not dying from war with Iraq that they were in the 1980s. They're now dying from heart disease, stroke, road injuries, suicide, other kinds of violence that have nothing to do with outside forces. And so, yeah, they restructured their entire road system. This is a global problem. I was shocked to learn in reporting for Epic Measures that worldwide road injuries, mainly car crashes, kill more people than AIDS. Global funding for health aid for AIDS is about 1/3 of our development assistance for health. Meanwhile, road injuries is such a small category of aid, trying to make roads safer in other countries, that it's not even tracked.
I just remember being impressed by the story because they saw the data, they fired the transportation person, and they started rebuilding their roads, and the death toll went way, way down.
It's a radical approach. Try to solve the problems you actually have rather than what you think the problems you might have are. Look at the evidence first. It shouldn't be radical, but it is. Mexico did the same thing. They saw, you know, huge increases in cancers, in road injuries, in heart disease. And they shifted their funding to cover those areas with their governmental assistance for health insurance. And they were able to achieve universal health coverage in Mexico, which just 15 years ago was in the same situation as the United States, where 50 million people lacked access to health insurance and therefore lacked access to health care altogether. They shifted to cover the problems people really had, and they were able to cover everyone.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Jeremy Smith, who is the author of Epic Measures, One Doctor, 7 Billion Patients. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed and find dozens of other The Right Question programs at our blog, located at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to the program on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the latest global burden study, which ranks the U.S. near the bottom and reveals a huge problem in Montana's Missoula County. Thank you. Chris Murray has been responsible for 3 global burden studies. Tell us a little bit about that history.
So the first one was published in 1993. It was a joint project of the World Bank and the World Health Organization. It was revelatory, and the impact led him to be hired to be basically a second in command at the World Health Organization, or WHO. And so by the time he's 35, he assumes this leadership position at WHO.
And then there was a report published in 2000,
right? And then
right?
In 2000, there was this very famous, very controversial report that not only gave new global burden of disease numbers, but then also tried to evaluate how well countries' health systems were responding to those problems. And it ranked them.
And France ranked number 1, and the United States was 37.
Yes. Well, we were number 1 in spending.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big gap between spending the most and having results, you know, closer to Slovenia or Cuba. So the way they ranked the national health systems was a combination of a few factors. It was how well people were in the country, how healthy they were, measured by life expectancy, but also by things like absence of disability or injury. They also looked at, do people have access to care? If you're sick, can you get help? So a system like the United States, where if you're poor, you're effectively barred from preventative care and often even treatment for major problems, that was costing Americans a lot of money and a lot of health, frankly. Other things were about whether the system responded to people's needs, if it matched to the problems people had. Here, the United States scored pretty well. Our system does adapt pretty well to consumer demand. There's just lots of people who, because of money or lack of insurance, don't have access to even be consumers. So France was covering everyone in their population. They were achieving better health results, and they were doing it at maybe half or a third of the cost per person of the United States. That's why they were ranked first, and the U.S. was ranked far lower.
And aren't there a lot of bankruptcies in the United States that are related to health care?
It's a leading cause of personal bankruptcy and business bankruptcy, or at least it was a few years ago. I don't know how the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, has changed that.
So when the new study came out in 2012, how did the rankings change?
So the first global burden of disease study was in 1993. Then it was taken over by the World Health Organization in 2000. And then, as you say, again, it was updated for a third time in 2012. Chris Murray, the leader of the Global Burden of Disease Study, published a 2010 analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine. And at that point, the U.S. still was number 1 in terms of healthcare spending per capita, but ranked 39th for infant mortality, 43rd for adult female mortality, 42nd for adult male mortality, and 36th for life expectancy. We were kind of in the middle of the pack in 1990 among other wealthy nations. We're now at the bottom.
Wow. But we spend the most money.
We spend far and away the most money. You know, I would again make that analogy of someone who's lost. You know, we want to move to a healthier place where people can all live longer and better lives. And our solution in the United States is to just go faster and faster and faster rather than stopping and consulting a map.
Well, now we have the map. And Chris was kind of forced out of WHO. The World Health Organization got a new director who completely cut the program that Chris was working on that produced the global burden of disease, right?
Yeah. You know, this work was very controversial because it questioned all the previous estimates that aid and advocacy groups had put forth. Everyone wanted to make sure their cause was the most prominent. So when you added up all their different claims, you found everyone in the world died 2 or 3 times over. And meanwhile, countries sometimes want to look better, so they spiff up their health statistics so they can get reelected. And sometimes they want to look worse so they can appeal to donors and aid agencies and say, we deserve your billions of dollars or millions of dollars. So the idea of giving an independent, objective assessment of health conditions in every country was very controversial. It stepped on a lot of toes.
So he leaves WHO and he goes back to Harvard, and he thought he had the funding for the next study, but that fell through.
Yeah. When you make a map like this, it has to be constantly updated because health conditions are constantly changing. If you solve one problem, if you vaccinate children so they no longer die of, you know, malaria or measles, then they're still susceptible to other conditions later in life. If a woman doesn't die giving birth, then she could get cancer and suffer that, or a car accident, or anything else, or back pain, or depression. So you have to constantly be updating this map. Where was he going to get the money to do that? He goes hand in hand to Larry Ellison, the founder and CEO of Oracle, the database giant, I think one of the 10 richest people in the world. And they have wild adventures, which I talk about in Epic Measures, where, you know, Chris Murray is racing on an America's Cup yacht with Larry Ellison. Ellison very publicly, very grandly makes a commitment to give, I think, $125 million to Harvard, the largest gift in that institution's history. And they're going to restart the study. They're going to constantly be updating it. And then Ellison ends up changing his mind, and Murray's left with nothing. He's got to start over. Luckily, there's one other billionaire whose door he can try knocking on, Bill Gates.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation ultimately funded the 2012 study.
And they funded it. It's independent of them. What Murray realizes is, I've got to make this an independent academic effort. It's got to be closer to the Human Genome Project rather than something owned by any particular country or advocacy group or even the entire United Nations system, which is still a political system. So it becomes a consortium of about 500 scientists in 50 to 100 countries around the world, and he's going to lead the sort of coordinating institution. Now, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, meanwhile, is committed to giving away almost all of Bill Gates's money, and they're giving the lion's share of it away to the cause of global health. But what cause is that? What are the diseases they should focus on? What are the countries they should focus on? What are the age groups they should focus on? And then say they spend billions of dollars a year, as they do. How do they know if what they're doing is working? They need the map to be constantly updated to see if they're bending the curves, as they say in the tech industry. Can you, you know, change survival? Can you improve outcomes? If you don't have a map, you have no idea.
Part of what makes this such an interesting story is that Chris Murray is pulling everybody in the world together to give this information. How many countries are in the world? 190-some?
Yeah.
And he's got almost all of them sending him data down to the counties in various countries. And this is a huge thing that's now available online. I can go look at it and see who got snake bites in what country and how many people died from that. It's just astounding.
What I love about it is you can be like Bill Gates and say, I'm going to try to save the world. What's the biggest problem in the world? And you can look it up. Or you can say, you know, I care about women, or I care about children, or I care about Thailand. Or you can say, you know what, I actually just care about Missoula County, and I want to zoom all the way into Missoula County, or I want to just zoom into men between the ages of 35 and 40 in Missoula County. I just looked up the Missoula numbers, and again, these are constantly being updated, and I saw that Missoula has a drinking problem. Maybe it's because we're a college town, but we are among the worst 10% of all counties in the United States when it comes to heavy drinking and binge drinking. At the same time, we're doing pretty well when it comes to obesity and physical activity. We're actually among the top 10% in those areas. And we're sort of good to fair when it comes to smoking. So even though we're a relatively poor county, we're right at the median pretty much for the country and for the state. Our life expectancy is better than average while still not being great because our sort of downsides are outweighed by our good sides. But we can look at this drinking issue we have and say, wow, a lot of illness, injury, disease, death is coming out of this particular risk factor. Can we address it while maintaining our good performance in these other areas, which we might be taking for granted, and they can easily slide? Counties that have used this data to improve include, for example, New York City, which saw life expectancy increases of about a decade in the last generation. So that means if you're a kid born today in New York City, you're likely to live 10 years longer than you would have just a generation ago. At the same time, there are places in the U.S. where life expectancy is declining. In 1 in 4 U.S. counties, if you're a woman born today, a baby girl, you are likely to live less long than your mother. And that's the first time that's happened in U.S. history without there being an accompanying epidemic or war of some kind. So this data sees where we're succeeding, how to copy that success, and where we're really struggling.
Well, it's so exciting because a county government, a state government, a country government can go to these statistics and say, where is our money best used? What's the biggest problem and how can we address it? And so public funds are spent more wisely and they're targeting the actual problems instead of emotions running the whole public health department.
Yeah, in 1970, Australia and the United States had just about the exact same life expectancy outcomes. Australia started using this data early on. And now if you live in Australia, you're far ahead of the United States. For men, life expectancy in Australia is on par with Japan.
Which is at the top of the heap.
Which is at the top of the heap. And, you know, it's not by accident. I mean, they directed $1 billion in their own public health spending over the last 5 years towards specifically addressing the problems that they see pop up on this map.
What compelled you to write this book and what do you want people to know? What's the big takeaway you want people to remember from listening to this program?
I wanted to write this book because I got to tell a mystery story, an adventure story, and a thriller. And the mystery is, what really kills people and makes them sick? And I was shocked to learn we have not known that in a reliable way.
Until Chris Murray came along.
And the adventure is this race around the world to fill in the gaps in that information, to go everywhere from the green zone in Baghdad to New York City, to Washington, D.C., London, Geneva, Syria, wherever you want, and fill in that information. And then the thriller is, once you have the answers, once you know what really kills people and makes them sick, once you know what their greatest risks are, can you get that information to the public? Can you get that information to the people in power? And when you succeed, how quickly and how much can outcomes improve? Because you can always say, oh, it's just the rich people or the poor people. But then when you see people in the same place make really big gains or fall back, that gives you inspiration that, no, we can actually make a difference in these places and improve life for everyone.
You can see the global burden of disease statistics at healthdata.org. More information about Jeremy Smith and his book, Epic Measures, is at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links are also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.